This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Joe Palca in Washington, sitting in for Neil Conan. Just a little over an hour ago, President Bush announced his nomination of National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice as the new Secretary of State. She would replace Colin Powell, who announced his resignation yesterday. In making his announcement, President Bush spoke of Ms. Rice's qualifications.
She is a recognized expert in international affairs, a distinguished teacher and academic leader, and a public servant with years of White House experience. She displays a commitment to excellence in every aspect of her life, from shaping our strategy in the war on terror to coordinating national security policy across the government to performing classical music on stage. Above all, Dr. Rice has a deep, abiding belief in the value and power of liberty because she has seen freedom denied and freedom reborn.
After the president's remarks, Condoleezza Rice took the stage and thanked the president for how he spoke and said she looked forward to working closely with State Department employees.
Let me say that in my 25 years of experience in foreign affairs, both in and out of government, I have come to know the men and women of the Department of State. I have the utmost admiration and respect for their skill, their professionalism, and their dedication. If I am confirmed by the Senate, I look forward to working with the great people of the Foreign Service and the Civil Service. And one of my highest priorities as Secretary will be to ensure that they have all the tools necessary to carry American diplomacy forward in the 21st century.
As National Security Advisor, Condoleezza Rice has been one of President Bush's closest confidants. She has been a loyal backer of military actions in both Afghanistan and Iraq. And in testimony before the 9/11 Commission, she defended the work of the U.S. intelligence community. If confirmed as Secretary of State, she would become the first black woman and only the second woman ever to serve as the nation's top diplomat. Later in the program, we'll be talking about the Senate Judiciary Committee and whether Arlen Specter will become its chair. But first, Condoleezza Rice and the changing of the cabinet. What impact will her appointment have on U.S. foreign policy? Does this nomination signal a change in the Bush administration's outlook? And later, we'll be talking about the nuts and bolts of cabinet appointments. So call in with your questions as to how these changes work. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. Joining us now to talk about Condoleezza Rice are Leslie Gelb, President Emeritus at the Council of Foreign Relations, on Foreign Relations, excuse me. He has also been a senior official in the State and Defense Departments. He joins us by phone from his home in New York. Welcome.
Good to be here.
And also James Mann, author of Rise of the Vulcans, the History of Bush's War Cabinet. He joins us from the studio at the Brookings Institution in D.C. Welcome back to the show.
Good to be with you.
Oh, good. I thought we'd lost you there for a second. So why don't we start with you, James Mann. We were speculating yesterday on this program about who might replace Secretary Powell. First of all, are you surprised we heard so soon? And second of all, are you surprised that it was Condoleezza Rice?
I'm not surprised we heard so soon. I thought as soon as that President Bush would move very quickly after the announcement of Colin Powell's resignation. I wasn't sure whether it would be Condoleezza Rice or John Danforth. I'd been thinking for months it would be Condoleezza Rice. There were reports just in the last week or so that maybe she didn't want the job, but either she decided she did or President Bush decided she did.
And Leslie Gelb, do you have any particular insight into that question, whether it was something that she wanted or whether something the president urged her to do?
Surprised me. Everyone knew that Colin Powell would leave sometime within the first year, probably the first month. But I believe that he would have stayed longer and wanted to stay longer. And I think what happened was he went to see the president, as he hinted at in his departure statement yesterday, and told the president he would stay on under certain conditions. And the president said, well, I'm not going to do what you say about North Korea, Iran, and other things, and maybe we ought to move now to do what you had been planning to do all along. So I think Powell precipitated this, and I think it happened suddenly.
Really? Because when the secretary stood up, he said it was always his intention to serve one term. Do you think he was being...
No, I think he was telling the truth. I just don't think he expected to resign within a few weeks of the election. I think he expected to do it in January or February after a kind of cleaner, smoother transition.
Joe.
It was abrupt and sudden, and I think he even hinted at it in his statement yesterday.
Yes, James Mann, you were saying.
Yeah, that matches my understanding. When I said I wasn't surprised, once Powell resigned, I wasn't surprised that Bush moved very quickly to replace him.
Uh-huh.
But there was this period of about a week, again, after the election, when Powell's people seemed to suggest that they might want to stay on, not even for a couple months, but maybe through June or so. And my understanding is the same as Les Gelb's, that there was a meeting with the president, and it was decided quite quickly that the president was going to replace him.
Well, that's interesting. Then I guess that suggests that, Secretary Powell has been considered a moderating voice in the administration. How effective he's been, I guess, is open to question. But does that suggest that the moderating voices are no longer necessary or essential, and it's now full steam ahead on a direction that we will soon become, you know, completely familiar with?
Well, I know many people think that. I would say that the main factor was that Bush wanted to establish his own political control of the State Department. Powell was always an independent force, and he just wanted someone close to himself there. Now, it is definitely true that Rice tends to be more hawkish than Powell. I don't know, though, what that is going to mean for policy. You could argue that because Powell was mistrusted by the Bush people from the beginning, that what he argued tended to be discounted. And then if Rice argues even the same policies, she may make more headway. We don't know.
Okay. We're talking with James Mann and Leslie Gelb from the Council on Foreign Relations. Did you want to add something to that?
I think Jim's right on. In fact, if you really want your listeners to get a good sense of Condi Rice and the other key people in this administration, they should read Jim's book called The Vulcans, which is what Condi Rice and the Bush advisors during the campaign 4 years ago called themselves. It's still far and away the best insight into their culture and their thinking. These were people who were transformationalists in American foreign policy. They weren't what we would call moderate. They were moderates, basically people who emphasized continuity, slow change, and the like. These are people who really intended on shaking things up, as Jim describes in that book, The Vulcans, and they did, and very quickly.
Let's hear from our listeners as we discuss this this new nomination, and let's go first to George in Kansas City, Missouri. George, welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you. I was on yesterday, actually, when we had been talking about the Secretary of State and who he was, and I had put forward her name as a possibility. I'm wondering now if I've heard that there's been a little bit of friction between her and Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld, and wonder if there's going to be any sparks in the administration and involving those two.
Okay, George.
Take my answer off the air.
Okay, thanks, George. Leslie Gelb, is that something you can speak to at all?
I think that, you know, these things are all mysterious, and unless you're there, you don't know for sure. But their relations were pretty good, and I think Condi sided more with Don Rumsfeld the last 4 years than with Colin Powell. But they did have a set too, over who was going to have responsibility in Iraq about 6 or 8 months ago for coordinating and making policy. You know, NSC was supposed to be doing that all along. Apparently, Condi Rice didn't do it, and then she was re-given that authority by the president and had some meeting with Rumsfeld where she didn't tell him that she had been re-given the authority, and then it was announced publicly, and I guess Rumsfeld was a bit miffed. Is that how you understand it, Jim?
James May.
Yes, it is. Let me point to one thing we don't know, and this affects her relations with Rumsfeld. Every government job that Condoleezza Rice has had, or the two main ones, have been at the National Security Council, where her job, particularly as she's seen it, has been one as a mediator. She's the mediator as the National Security Advisor between state and defense, or between, call it philosophically, between realists and idealists. I was struck when I reported on her role in the first Bush administration. There were debates on policy towards the Soviet Union, and even 10 years later, the hawks said, actually, Condi was with us on our side, and the dove right. said, no, she was really on our side.
Right.
Now she's in a position where she's going to be, and she has to be an advocate. She's not mediating between competing points of view. She's going to put forward a point of view, and I don't know yet how that's going to come out.
Let's take a call now from Sam in Portland, Oregon. Sam, welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you, Joe. It's great to be on.
Glad to have you.
Thank you. I was just wondering, what is the political inertia behind this cabinet shakeup, and could it involve a greater direction towards a higher influence of defense and security in foreign policy over diplomacy?
Over what?
Over diplomacy, I think Sam said.
There always was. I don't think that's new. I think basically the dominant attitude of the administration was that this wasn't a period for diplomacy. Diplomacy couldn't affect our adversaries very much, that you had to use muscle.
But I guess the question then from that is there enough muscle to go around? I mean, is there muscle for every world problem, or does diplomacy have a role someplace?
There isn't enough muscle for even the toughest of problems. You have to use diplomacy even there.
Yeah.
Should be using it in Iraq. That's one of the, I think, fair criticisms of this administration.
Sam, thanks very much for that call. James Mann, I wondered if I could ask you, isn't there a sort of a natural tension between the State Department and the Defense Department, and that there will always be some pulling from those two points of view?
Absolutely. So I think the dynamic you'll see will be in the first, particularly in the first few months, I think there'll be, we can probably see some tension between Rice as Secretary of State and her own troops at the State Department, because she's going to want to take the State Department in new directions, and in the White House point of view, establish control over the State Department. But then, and I can see news stories about unhappiness at State. Over the longer run, we may see then Rice having established herself at State, representing the point of view of diplomacy within the administration, in a way that has a greater voice within this particular administration than Colin Powell did.
Yeah, that could happen. But my guess is, in the short run, there could be every bit as much explosiveness in the State Department under Rice as there has been in the CIA under Porter Goss. There's great unhappiness in the State Department over her coming in and running the building.
Yeah, I was just going to ask, I mean, is there any sense that the State Department has fallen down in its job, as was the case with a new head of the CIA, that somehow it needed to shake up, Leslie Gelb?
Yeah, I think feeling in the White House was that both the CIA and the State Department were not on the team, that they had different points of view and that they couldn't win inside, so that they were taking the case outside through leaks.
That's interesting, because I'm really wondering about whether being on the job, maybe it means the same thing as being on the team, because but that's perhaps something we can take up after a short break. We're talking about Condoleezza Rice as the next Secretary of State, and we're taking your calls at 800-989-TALK. You can send us email. The address is totn@npr.org. I'm Joe Palca. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Joe Palca in Washington. We're talking about Condoleezza Rice and her new role as the designated Secretary of State. What do you think this change means for U.S. foreign policy? Join the discussion. Give us a call at 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. We have on the phone with us Leslie Gelb. He's President Emeritus of the Council on Foreign Relations. and also by a studio line from his office at the Brookings Institution, James Mann, the author of Rise of the Vulcans, the History of Bush's War Cabinet. And let's take another call now. First, let's go to Matt in Long Island, New York. Go ahead, Matt.
Hi. I would just like to know what your panel thinks about with Powell leaving and him being such a moderate voice in the administration, what they think that Condi Rice will put in some policy that... Can you still hear me?
Yes, we hear you fine. No, go ahead and finish the question, and we'll give you an answer.
Okay. With Powell leaving office, I would like to know, is this the rise of the neoconservative administration? Is the new policy going to be more what they want or more what they aimed for in the first 4 years?
Got it. Thanks, Matt. What do you think about that, James Mann?
Powell's leaving represents, above all, the departure of a most illustrious person who was, however, out of sync with the Bush foreign policy team from before they took office. On the neoconservatives, neoconservatives were, in the first administration, as everyone knows, the dominant influence on Iraq policy and elsewhere in the Middle East. If you look at the larger picture, the Bush administration's policy towards China or Russia were quite different from what the neoconservatives would have wanted. And secondly, the neoconservatives, the influence of the neoconservatives has been tarnished to some extent by the chaos in Iraq. Thirdly, this administration in its second term is limited by the fact that it's got to deal with Iraq and the mess in Iraq. So one way or another, the neoconservatives are influential, but maybe less so in this term than people expect right now.
Interesting. Leslie Elbe, I wonder if I can ask you, we were talking yesterday about the relatively favorable opinion that people throughout the world have had of Secretary Powell. Condoleezza Rice comes in probably perceived a little differently. Is that going to make her job more difficult, do you think?
Sure will, because she's perceived as an extension of President Bush, and most of the anti-Americanism in the world is centered on President Bush and his policies in particular. There's no one more closely associated with them than Condoleezza Rice and Vice President Cheney. So I think she will be regarded by most of her counterparts around the world with some suspicion and wariness. They like Colin Powell because he more or less saw the world the way they did. Responding to your previous question, he was regarded by most other foreign ministers as a fellow realist, and a realist deals with the world as it is. And basically, President Bush and the neocons together didn't want to keep the world as it was. They wanted to change it. They wanted to change reality.
Right. One of the things, at least that I've read, I don't know, maybe you can tell me if it's true, is that Secretary Powell stayed on as long as he did because of he wanted to make some change or to bring attention to the problem of the refugees in Darfur and in Sudan. Is that a problem you think that Condoleezza Rice will focus on? Maybe
no
Leslie Gelb. Yeah.
No idea.
James Mann, what do you think?
Yeah, I really don't know either. I think that in these are larger political changes that are not affected by specific on the ground situations other than the main one of Iraq.
You know, when the Bush administration took office again, I could stand to be corrected by Jim. I believe Condi Rice and others said that Africa was without strategic interest to the United States, and this wasn't a place where they were going to get heavily involved, particularly with any military force.
Interesting.
Yes.
let's take one more call. Nancy in Portland, Oregon, welcome to the program.
Hi.
Hi.
You calling me?
Yes, Nancy.
Yes.
You're Nancy.
Yes.
Good.
I think the president just said it all in his recent statement that you had on the news.
Uh-huh.
He referred to Condi. I think Dr. Rice is too close to him, and he wants to hear what he wants to hear. And if he couldn't hear it from Colin Powell, Dr. Rice will just tell our president what he wants to hear. And that concerns me a great deal.
Well, that's an interesting point, Nancy. We've been talking a little bit about that, Leslie Galba. Is the president, he claims, he said that he likes to hear a variety of voices, but is he bringing in the voices that that represent his kind of variety?
Well, I never saw much evidence that he's interested in hearing a variety of voices. And I think people who weren't on the same wavelength with him, by and large, fared very poorly in his first administration.
James Mann?
Let me. There are many criticisms of that one can make of this new appointment. But the one I think I would not make is that it's someone close to the president. That's not unprecedented. I would point out that Warren Christopher was close to Bill Clinton. That James Baker was extremely close to George Bush Sr. That this is something that presidents have tended to. To do in the past.
But Jim, can I say, with somebody like Jim Baker, I believe he was capable of saying anything to the first president, Bush, and did. And he wouldn't have hesitated if he thought something was really going to be a disaster to say that to the president. And it's not clear to me that Colin Powell did say anything like that, or that Condi Rice would say anything like that.
Right. Gentlemen, we only have about another minute in this segment. I wonder if I can ask you both quickly what your opinion is of Stephen Hadley, the man the president has picked to replace Condoleezza Rice. Leslie Galb.
Well, I think Jim and I both know him pretty well. He was also, before the start of the first Bush administration, someone I think should have been pegged as a kind of a classic conservative realist. A very sensible, open-minded guy, very hard-headed about the need for and use of power. And like Condi, he has had to be a defender of the faith, and I think after you defend the faith for all these years so close into the candle, you become a true believer.
Very good. James Mann?
Let me add one thing slightly different, though. The one key part of Steve Hadley's experience is that he was part of Dick Cheney's Pentagon in the first Bush administration. He was part of the team that included Paul Wolfowitz, Scooter Libby, now Cheney's chief of staff, Khalilzad. These are the team that put together really the vision that that this Bush administration has acted on. He is by style a very open, straightforward guy, but he's really been part of the vision for this administration from the start and even before it took office.
Okay, gentlemen, thank you very much. First, James Mann is the author of The Rise of the Vulcans, The History of Bush's War Cabinet. He joined us from the studio at the Brookings Institution in Washington, D.C. Thank you. And Leslie Galb is President Emeritus at the Council on Foreign Relations. He's also a senior fellow. He's been a senior fellow in the State Department and Defense Department's senior official, in the State. Too many fellows and officials, I'm sorry. In the State and Defense Departments, he joined us by phone from his home in New York. Thanks, both of you, for joining me.
Enjoy.
And joining us now to talk about what this appointment and some of the others and how means about how the cabinet works are Michael Duffy, the Washington Bureau Chief for Time Magazine. He joins us here in Studio 3A. Welcome.
Nice to be here.
And Paul Light, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and a professor of public service at New York University. He joins us by phone from his office in New York. Welcome.
Nice to be here.
So let me start with you, Michael Duffy. We were just talking about the change, if any, that this appointment means for the president's second term. What do you think Condoleezza Rice's appointment means in this context?
Well, I think if you look across all of the appointments he's made so far, what we see here is a president who's consolidating his power in the aftermath of his victory. And in a way that will make him even more in control of the government which he now heads. He has taken several of his most closest personal aides, whether it's Alberto Gonzalez, his White House counsel, or Condoleezza Rice, his White House foreign policy advisor, and now sent them like missionaries, out to these agencies, justice and state, and I suspect we'll get some more next week, that have not always been under the tent, have not always done exactly as they were supposed to. And now in these first appointments, he, and I think in the Education Department, he's taken another White House aide, Margaret Spellings, and sent her to Education. So we see a pattern here that was not surprising after an election, but it shows that the president is going to now finally wrap his arms around that part of the government, which wasn't always within his arms.
Paul Light, Condoleezza Rice is not officially confirmed yet. What has to happen first to actually go through the steps of having her confirmed as his new Secretary of State, the president's new Secretary of State?
Well, from a technical standpoint, she has to fill out a fairly dense inventory of forms that she's already done once, security clearance. I mean, they know her well in the White House, so I suspect that she'll be given some leeway on the White House forms. But, you know, it's a process that begins with a bunch of forms, and then you have to redo the forms and for the Senate confirmation. So she's got some paperwork to do. There'll have to be some consultation on Capitol Hill, you know, to have her meet with senators and so forth. But it's a fairly straightforward process for her. The question is, what will happen at the sub-cabinet level, where you've already got the Deputy Secretary of State on his way out, and what's she going to do with the sub-cabinet that Colin Powell developed and put in place upon his arrival, many of whom were career foreign or are career foreign service officers.
Let's hear what our listeners have to wondering about in this transition period, and I'd like to go first to Adam in Bethesda, Maryland. Adam, welcome to the program.
Hi. My question is, because I'm only almost 18, so I haven't sort of seen, you know, when there were two Clinton administrations or two Reagan administrations. When there's the second administration starting, is it traditional for there to be these kinds of internal promotions that we're seeing with Condoleezza Rice?
Okay, Adam, good question. Paul Light, maybe you want to tackle that?
It's not unusual to get this kind of turnover, although, you know, I really like the analysis of my colleague from Time. It's dead on target. You know, there's a fair amount of turnover between the first and second term. Clinton had the same turnover. Reagan had some turnover. What's different about this particular pattern is the population of these key jobs with White House staffers. Not unusual to have a national security advisor go to state, but you do have this effort to gain control of these prestige departments, justice and state. The turnover is not unusual, not unexpected, but it's very crisp. The Bush people have always been good at managing these kinds of transitions. They were very good in 2000, 2001, and they've been planning this transition, I would guess, for a good 6 months. They know what they're doing. They want to get it done and move on to the policy agenda as quickly as possible because they only have so much time to make their impact in their second term.
We're talking with Paul Light. He's a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and a professor of public service at New York University, and Michael Duffy, Washington bureau chief for Time magazine. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Michael Duffy, I just wondered, you know, you were saying, I liked your analogy of sending people out from the inner sanctum out, but, you know, there's a flip side to that, which is the when you're working in the White House, you see the president every day, you know, you're there all the time. Does he lose something by having these people go out? Is he going to have to fill in with, you know, the new people who are going to be seeing, he's literally going to be seeing in the hall every day?
Yeah, and these two are particularly close in an almost personal way. That's an interesting question. You know, Condoleezza Rice is almost a family friend. She often spent the weekends with the president at Camp David. She would go to church with him. They liked football together. They were close in a spectacularly, you know, unusual way. And I don't want to make too much of that. Just that they were very close friends. And this will be different for both of them. I'm kind of in agreement with the comment, I guess, that was made by Jim Mann, but which is that it probably isn't a bad thing to have this closeness. In the case of the Attorney General, it's a little different. You want an Attorney General who has some independence because the Justice Department isn't just the legal advisor. It's also an investigator, and sometimes they're called upon to investigate the administration. So that's a trickier question. The president's father had a very close relationship with his Secretary of State, James Baker, and I think, as the your previous guest said, that was a good thing.
Let me ask you, I guess, the other question, which is politically, is there any chance that this nomination will face a problem in the Senate?
No.
No. What, Paul Light, do you think there's any chance?
Maybe a few tough questions, but no, this is not a place where you really want to lay down the marker. I don't think you can stop either of these appointees or nominees from confirmation.
Go ahead.
I would only say the main question I think that Condi Rice will get is about, you know, about a year ago, Joe, the president handed responsibility for post-war Iraq policy to Rice. He took it away from Rumsfeld because it was going so badly and said, here, you do this. We need to have it closer. I need to be right on top of this. I don't want somebody else running it. She will get questions about how it's going and the sort of two-track military political strategy she's got there. But I think that'll be the hottest moment of the hearings.
Maybe I can also ask, is this something that can happen in the lame duck session, or will this take place in the next session?
It could happen, but it won't. They'll wait until they have the new committee arranged. They have better margins, Republicans. It'll happen very quickly, inside of a week, I suspect, once they return.
I see. Paul Light, is it unusual? If the president wanted to, could he pick his entire new cabinet today and initiate the process right away? Or has that ever happened, I wonder?
Well, I think the process has already been initiated, but in terms of the vetting and so forth, you've got to get these people in the pipeline. But the tradition is to nominate them on Inauguration Day, and the Senate will come into session right after inauguration and confirm them. So you have to get all the paperwork in order, but, you know, it's part of the grand transition that occurs on the formal day of inauguration, and that'll happen here. The sub-cabinet will take much longer to replace, you know, well into next year, certainly through mid-year at a minimum.
I imagine that, you know, the president was able partly to move so quickly because most of the forms had already been filled out for these two people, and he knew that he didn't have to worry about any surprises, which I guess is always the case when you bring in somebody from the outside.
Well, there's no doubt that they've been working on this for a while. They're just very effective at transitioning. But one of the ironies of the presidential appointments process, which is just as cumbersome as can be, is that prior appointees who've been through the process actually face a little more delay because the FBI likes to check their old answers against their new answers in search of possible discrepancies.
Afraid we have to stop there. Paul Light is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, and Michael Duffy is Washington Bureau Chief for Time Magazine. When we come back from a short break, we'll talk about the controversy surrounding Pennsylvania Senator Arlen Specter. I'm Joe Palca. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Joe Palca in Washington. Tomorrow, bankruptcies in the airline industry have companies dumping their pensions responsibility on the federal government, leaving tens of thousands of retirees with smaller checks and canceled health benefits. What does this mean for the future of the U.S. pension system? That's on tomorrow's show. And here are some of the stories NPR is following this afternoon. Al Jazeera TV has a videotape showing the slaying of a woman believed to be kidnapped aid worker Margaret Hassan. Hassan was the director of CARE International in Iraq, and the U.S. military is investigating the videotape killing of a wounded man by a U.S. Marine. The Red Cross says it's not clear whether the man was a prisoner and therefore protected by the Geneva Conventions. Those stories coming up this afternoon on All Things Considered. Today, we're talking about cabinet changes. What questions do you have about the process, about how the president makes his selections, and about how the Congress, the Senate in this case, confirms those selections? And maybe we can go back to some of the selections that were not confirmed. That happens occasionally, although it doesn't look like, at least so far, that's likely to happen in this case. You're welcome to join the conversation. Call us at 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. And if I gave you all the impression that we were done talking with Michael Duffy, Washington Bureau Chief of Time Magazine, who's still here in 3A, and Paul Light, Senior Fellow from the Brookings Institution, who joins us from his office in New York City, I apologize because we aren't done talking with them. They're still here on the line with us and in the studio with me. So we'll talk a little bit more about, maybe we can talk about Alberto Gonzalez, Michael Duffy, and whether he faces a more difficult time, perhaps a little bit less of a public figure, maybe a little less known, although I'm certain he's familiar to people in Washington.
And in fact, I think that's one of the reasons we're going to have an interesting confirmation hearing with Gonzalez. He, of course, has been named to be Attorney General. The big questions about him are his role in a series of legal opinions which grew out of the war on terror and the ways in which the administration tried to stretch the rules about interrogation of prisoners, treatment of prisoners, and right up to the line of torture. There were some legal members, I'm sure, that the senators will want to not just talk about with Gonzalez, but perhaps see, that haven't actually been made public, they haven't been able to get their hands on, that Gonzalez sort of coordinated in 2002. That'll sort of be the heart of that. And the other reason to watch that hearing is that many people believe that President Bush will someday perhaps name Alberto Gonzalez to the Supreme Court if there is he gets more than one chance to name a justice. And oftentimes people go through hearings, nomination hearings, once in order to clear up problems so they don't have them the second time around. So this is really a dress rehearsal in some ways, should he ever be named a Supreme Court justice.
That's interesting. Well, I was going to say, should we make you make a prediction now? But no, we'll leave that for another time. I'm not going to put you on the spot.
Thank you.
We have an email question here from Pete in Portland, Oregon, who writes, is there a simple distinction between what you called a White House staffer and a cabinet-level position? Can you clarify somewhat how those roles differ? Paul Light, what's the difference between being a national security advisor and a secretary of state in terms of status?
Well, one serves entirely at the pleasure of the president, is appointed by the president without Senate confirmation. The other serves with the advice and consent of the Senate and can be called to testify. White House staff are not allowed to testify before Congress. They're, in theory, immune from certain investigatory powers of Congress under executive privilege and so forth. But, I mean, running a large department of the federal government that's existed since the very beginning of the Republic is an important and prestigious post, although it does have a kind of sobering effect to now be running something with that many people under your command. And I think Dr. Rice may soon find that managing the Department of State is as difficult a challenge as anything she's faced previously in her life.
I was going to ask you, Paul, is there a significant difference between directing the National Security Council, I guess there has to be, which is much smaller, and directing the State Department, which is a pretty enormous federal agency?
Well, State is an unusual department. It's very wide, a large number of assistant secretaries covering every part of the globe. It's amorphous. She will need a strong deputy secretary. Armitage really did play an important role for Powell on the inside of that department, which has historically been difficult to command. And she's going to find that she'll need a good deal of help and perhaps some management support at the deputy secretary level. It's a hard place to manage, that's for sure.
Okay, thanks. Michael Duffy, any final thoughts? Do you think we'll see many more or any more cabinet departures?
I think by Thanksgiving we're going to see one more round. I've reason to think that the Department of Homeland Security Chief Tom Ridge is going to leave, and HHS, Health and Human Services Secretary Tommy Thompson, is also going to leave. And the pattern has been that they announce them in a group, and I suspect they'll try to replace them in a group too, probably before Thanksgiving.
Okay. Gentlemen, now I will say goodbye, and this time I mean it. Michael Duffy is the Washington Bureau Chief for Time Magazine. He joined us here in Studio 3A. And Paul Light is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and a professor of public service at New York University. He joined us by phone from his office in New York. Thanks to both of you.
Thanks a lot.